Hi, welcome to another episode of my podcast, and it's a little bit different today. Normally, I like to dive into the music of a few different unsigned artists. Today, it's an interview. It's a chat with a more established DJ, producer, an artist in his own right, who can perhaps give a leg up to unsigned artists, unsigned DJs or producers who are needing a bit of advice, because it's obviously such a difficult industry to navigate. To say that I'm excited would be a massive understatement. This guy is a British songwriter, record producer, and DJ. He's got quite an iconic image. He wears a pig helmet, which I get into chatting to him about a little bit more because it definitely intrigued me. As a DJ, Nick has performed at festivals and venues all around the world. Iconic places including Tomorrowland, Mysteryland, V-Fest, Boardmasters, and Ministry of Sound Club. I've got some chart statistics to read out for you. This is the sort of guy that we're dealing with right now. We're dealing with someone who's had 3 UK top 10 singles, 3 UK top 40s, has spent 17 weeks in the top 10 in the singles charts, and has spent 43 weeks in the top 40. The guy is just an absolute hit machine. And if you don't already know Nick through working with artists, most notably like KSI or Anne-Marie, maybe you know him from lead singles like Only One with Sigala, or Digital Love with Hayley Steinfeld, or maybe Millionaire with Cash Cash featuring Nelly. And if you don't know him for that, then maybe you're aware of his songwriting and production credits that includes Dua Lipa, Netski, Galantis, Jones, Cedric Gervais. I mean, this guy is an absolute force. He works across so many projects with so many different artists and writes such instantly recognisable pop and dance music. And I think that's testament to his absolutely incredible talent. And I'm so thankful that he's given me his time. This is my podcast, the Ben Curley Podcast. And this is my conversation with Digital Farm Animals. The last thing that I saw of you, other than listening to the music that you've been putting out, I saw you on stage at the Brits, and that was a weird moment for me because I was like, damn, that's you on stage and I'm going to chat to you soon. And it was so great seeing you on stage. You had KSI, you had Anne-Marie doing their thing, singing Don't Play. And seeing you do that at that level of event is unbelievable, because I can't even imagine what that experience must be like being on stage. And does it carry any extra weight for you when it's in front of peers as opposed to, say, fans that already know and love your music?
Thank you, mate. I appreciate that. Well, I'll be honest with you. I don't have to do too much when I'm up there, because obviously a lot of it, you know, you're not actually playing the music live. Sorry to anyone who thought we were. But, I mean, they're singing live, but when you DJ, generally the vibe is that you're kind of, it's kind of pre-played. So you just got to make sure you don't make a fool of yourself, really. And I said actually the other day in an interview, KSI actually gave me some very good advice, and he's obviously mastered kind of social media and everything to do with pretty much being famous. But he said, if it goes well, then brilliant, you get a round of applause, and if it goes terribly badly and you stack it, then you become a meme anyway, and you actually probably become more famous than if you just did a good performance. So you can't really lose, as long as you're not rude to anyone or make too much of a fool of yourself. So I tried to keep that in the back of my mind, but I was a bit nervous. Yeah, it's a bit weird, and I'll be honest with you, I remember before and after, I don't really remember the minute, because there's just so much adrenaline, you're just trying to kind of stay composed and like just do the right things. And for me, there were a few cues that I had to follow, and I, you know, you're still kind of responsible for making sure it all goes to plan and stuff. So it was great. In answer to your question about your peers, I suppose to an extent, I mean, like, I was just happy to have my family and everyone there with me. And it's just, you just got to enjoy it. And actually that night I really did enjoy it, because I'm often like the kind of, I'm always like, I don't know, I suppose one of my weaknesses is that I very rarely like kind of step back and be like, do you know what, actually, like, we're very lucky, we've done well or whatever. Yeah. And like, grateful, and whilst I am grateful, I think I'm always like, okay, how do I work harder, what's next. But on that night we were all just like, this is mental, so like, let's enjoy it. And we did, which was good, and it was really fun.
Yeah, for sure, it was fun watching it. And you're similar to, KSI JJ, in the sense that I've seen interviews with him before where he's like, you know, I rarely stop to take it all in. It's always about how can I level up? What's the next thing? Which I want to get on.
Well, he's on a whole nother level, but yeah, he's doing a million things at once. But yeah, he is like that for sure. He's and that's what makes him humble as well. But he's always like a million miles an hour with 10 massive things at once, you know.
Mm. And I want to get into some of the other amazing artists you've worked with. To be honest, we won't have time to go through all of it because you've worked with so many people. Just take me back to the start. How did it all begin for you? When did the ball start rolling with your production and your DJing?
So I've been making music for the best part of, how old am I now? I'm 34, I think. 33 or 34. I always forget. I started making music when I was 13, so that's 20 years ago. And that was my best mate, Nick, who DJed with me for a long time. We still work together a lot, and he's killing it as a manager now. Nick Myers, shout out to him. He gave me a CD with some software on it, Fruity Loops, which I still use today, and I just became like obsessed with it. It was like, I suppose, I enjoy playing football and tennis, but I've never become obsessed with them like some of my mates are. But with this, it was like obsession, and I just love the idea that you can essentially just sit there and create songs with like your hands. I just use a mouse. That's pretty much it. I don't play any instruments, and like step by step, learned to make beats, and I would make a million ideas that I never finished before. And then I suppose like it was really that was when I was 13. So by the time I went to uni, I remember I was doing it still there, like crazy amounts. I was doing it every night, pretty much. I would like trap myself away in my room, just making beats till like 4 a.m. in the morning and annoying my parents in our little two bedroom house. And so when I was at uni, I'd already been doing it for like 7 years. But I think then that's when I had like loads of time on my hands to just do it like all day long in between my like one class a day or whatever they teach nowadays. Following that, I studied history, and then I went on to do law as well, because my parents were always kind of like, they knew how much I loved it, but they were kind of like sensibly like, and I would say the same thing to my kids, like go and get a backup. I'd say the same thing to anyone. So I went and did a history degree, and then I studied law as well. And I did the whole thing. So I did essentially 5 years of university. I screwed up one of my modules on the last year, so that meant I had to retake it, which was going to take like 6 months extra.
Right.
So I said to myself, like, I was going to focus on that, and like, because that was really, it was only one module, so it wasn't taking up the whole way. I was working in a bar doing that, and then like the rest of my time was just music. And I'd always had this plan that I would like give myself a year to try and do music at some point. That was coupled with the fact that I also was trying to get a job in law, because you know, you don't expect it to work, the music, and I just wasn't having any luck. So I kind of knocked that on the head and said, like, I'm just gonna go full at it for a year. At that point, I met my manager. I also met a good friend of mine who works for me now, called Jason Sharp, who's looking at me now and scratching his head, who's putting me in quite a few sessions at the time. And I was just kind of getting, I was like kind of just dipping my toe a little bit more than I have been, and actually writing as opposed to just like sitting at a computer. And then sorry, this is a very long-winded answer.
No, it's all good, man.
It's
all good.
It feels like a long time ago. Well, it was a long time ago. And then so during that year, when I'd met Mark, my manager, he obviously was like a big part of like turning it in from a little hobby to like still not a career, but something that was more serious. And I was getting like a few sessions in and stuff, like just with unknown writers, and like starting to get some organization. That's the one thing I'm terrible at. And then he basically went and played my music to some guys in the US, and I was off my first publishing deal. And then that's the point when I was kind of like, I can do this now, because I, you know, it wasn't a lot of money, but it was enough to not worry for a year, let's say, and, you know, live not particularly comfortably, but just be able to pay bills and like get my parents off my back of, will you actually make any money of this, you know? So that was the point. And then, in a quick answer to what was the turning point, was when I produced Be The One for Dua Lipa. And then I suppose that, dude, when that went in Europe, that was like, now I suppose like, A, I've had a hit, and B, people start to get interested and you get more opportunities. So from then on, I feel like I've just kind of always just trying to hustle and go from one to the next, you know?
Yeah. And you mentioned something really interesting there. You mentioned how you met your manager. Now, for an unsigned artist listening who's maybe not even really stepped foot properly into the industry yet, where do you go to meet these influential people that help you along your journey?
Yeah, well, I mean, to put that into perspective, my manager was, I was 21, I think, and he was 23, or 22, he was 23, and he had one other guy, and he'd never done anything really. Like, so he was essentially just a local kid that called himself a manager. Huh. He now is a very successful manager, but he was, just the same, a guy that wanted to be in music in industry, a cocky 23-year-old kid who's very good at business, essentially. We got on very well. We were sorry, Mark, for saying that, but you know it's true. we were introduced by a local friend of ours, and thanks to him as well, his name's Ollie, if he ever listens, kind of hit it off from then, you know. He came with a contact book of loads of people. I think he'd done some work experience at record labels and stuff, and he just wanted to do it himself, and he basically would just hustle himself and went into, he flew out like on his own money, flew out to like New York and met people and stuff, you know, and just, he's just very good at that. And like, I don't think there's a cheat code for that kind of stuff. You've kind of either got it or you haven't, the hustle side of it. It's very necessary though, but he's good at that. He's good at business and he's always good at finding and creating opportunities. Maybe that's not that helpful. I suppose to some extent it's like fake it till you make it.
Mate, so many people do that. I'm still doing that. You know, it's kind of part of it, because you almost have to half the battle, I feel. And even as something as simple as you had to prove to your parents that you could stand on your own two feet with what you were doing, I feel like half the battle is actually kind of winning other people over. You know you're good, but
yeah,
it's kind 100%. Of proving to other people, I can actually do this and I am actually good at what I do.
No, 100%. And do you know what? I do actually remember a few things he used to tell me before meetings, which were like, all really, really interesting, quite smart moves. And like he used to say, beginning, make sure anyone you meet, like, tell them you want to be the biggest producer in the world. Not like successful. Like you've got to back yourself to the And we actually believe that. I don't think I will be the biggest producer in the world still, but I still would like, you know, still would like to be every day trying to make the best song ever. And also he used to do something else, which people might not know, but I think it's fine to say now. He used to literally go into meetings and record the meetings so he could hear back afterwards what he had said and stuff. Wow. And like kind of then go to the next meeting and he'd kind of know what to do or not to do or what went down well or what. It's little things like that, you know, like it all matters.
Of course it does. Everything adds into it.
It's like acting to an extent, really.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And something that I love about what you do is how many different facets there are to your game. You know, you've got production, you do writing, you do DJing. And I want to just focus on the DJing for a minute, because, I mean, you've done unbelievable sets. You've been to Tomorrowland, you've been V-Fest, Boardmasters, Ministry of Sound Club, all the rest of it. But I don't come from that world. I come from the world of being with a band and plugging in guitars and playing that way. So I know what goes into making a good, you know, rock set, for instance. What makes a good DJ set? What are the technicalities that another DJ would stand there and be like, oh yeah, he's sick live, he's a good DJ? Because I wouldn't know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I've got to give a lot of props to Nick for this, who for many years DJed with me, because he would put countless hours into like researching the music that goes down well, essentially like doing the set before you play it, which every time takes hours and hours and hours. And then once you have the songs that you like, you've got to kind of be able to judge the crowd as well. And there's little things that always go wrong in the moment and stuff. You just got to be very on top of it. You're essentially like a hype man as well, you know. It's just about keeping people entertained on their night out. To some extent it's really easy, because a lot of the time people are like really drunk, so as long as you kind of do the right things and they will be happy. There's levels of it as well. And I'm actually, it's funny you say that I'm really not from that world either. And I would say, like, of everything I've done in my career, I would say the DJing side of it has probably been the bit that's the less impressive bit. It's not like I wouldn't say that I'm like, you know, I'm really a DJ. I'm a producer and I'm a songwriter. That's really what I do, and that's where my strengths are. But DJing, we've done bits. I made a conscious decision a few years back, because I've got a family, I've got two little girls, and it was kind of either, do you want to be a producer and write for other people as your priority? And I also run a publishing company as well with various others, and with Jason, who's right here, and my manager Mark, And do you want to do all that, or do you want to go and be like a, you know, attempt to be a global DJ where you're going to be away every weekend and be a, essentially, I'd find it very hard to be the best dad if I'm never around. So, you know, without accusing other DJs of not being good dads, because I'm sure people balance it very well, it just felt like it was, I just felt a little guilty, you know? So I think that side of it, I've not done as much as maybe I could have. So my experience is definitely more in the songwriting and production side of things. But yeah, it's definitely not easy. That's for sure. And that, I suppose that goes with it as well. You need, you know, and that's probably the same with bands, but there's just so much flying around. And these guys play like 3-4 sets a night and stuff. And it's just crazy. Probably exhausting, you know? So yeah, it's a whole different ballgame. But I spend a lot of my time writing and producing for DJs, which is interesting.
Yeah, and I want to get onto that. Well, I suppose I'll get onto it now, really. And this is me jumping around the timeline a little bit. But you signed your record deal in 2015. And then kind of after that, you're popping up on tracks with Sigala, and you had that amazing Cash collaboration that I still like. I listen to a lot. I really like the Millionaire remixes that you did. So I suppose the first thing that I want to ask about that is, when you're working on a remix, what is it that you're looking for in the song to manipulate and change and warp into something else? What is it when you listen to a certain track that jumps out that makes you think, right, I can put my own thing on this?
I don't know if I have a sound, but then a lot of people tell me that they know a song when I've done it. So yeah, I don't know.
I'd agree with
that.
I'd agree with that. I do think you've got your own fingerprint.
I hope that's the case. I think it's more about the kind of progressions that I veer towards. I like emotional music generally. Like most stuff I do will have quite a bit of emotion in it. And I'll probably just try and put my own spin on something if I think it can be turned into something different. I think naturally a lot of the time I can't help but make things slightly more poppy, I think. So often you will rarely find me taking a song and making like the hard dance floor remix. It doesn't, that's just not really my thing. So you're probably more likely to find me take a song that feels more clubby and make it a bit more of a pop version or some kind of like alternative pop. And I've always like, if everyone's going, my theory has always been, if everyone always goes left, then try and go right. And that's generally the way I write as well. Like, you know, people moving trends here when you don't really want to get going in the middle or the end of a trend. So I kind of approach my remixes and my productions like that as well, just try and do something a little different. You know, I suppose it was the same when we did Don't Play. Like, yes, obviously I grew up listening to garage, so someone like myself knows there's thousands of garage tunes, and there were a few that year even, but there weren't loads and that did the proper garage thing. So we were like, why don't we do a garage tune? And then now I literally can't think of anything worse than doing a garage tune, it's got something different, a different element in it. You know, go and do an indie garage song or something like that. You know, I suppose there's people like Pink Panthers in that side of things, but it's just like, what can you do to make people a little surprised?
Sure. And how do you go about picking the artist that you work with? Because I'm guessing that you want to go with artists that are kind of aligned. I hate to use this word because it sounds a bit corny, but I suppose you go for artists that you want to be aligned with your vision. You want to be with artists that are kind of sharing what you want to get out of a song. How do you go about picking the right artists, and is there a process to that?
Normally, it's just who do we think is going to sound best on the record, or who's the record best for, and who will sell the record best in terms of it making sense for them, you know? There's no point me doing a hip-hop record and, you know, giving it to Charlotte Church.
Yeah.
Sorry, I couldn't think of anyone else. I'd love to work with Charlotte Church. But, yeah, I don't know. I think it's generally who do we think is going to fit best, and also not everyone wants to work with me as well. So, you know, I've still yet to get in with some of the of my idols, because they just don't even know who I am. I'd love to work with the cliche as it is, like the Coldplays and the Drakes and the Rihannas and stuff, you know, but time will come.
Of course it will, man. I'm sure I'll see that in the future. Well, yeah, because Coldplay came out and they were like, oh yeah, 2025, we're hanging it up. But do you know what? I think they'll be asking a bit longer.
Exactly.
When you're in the studio, let's say with some of the artists you've worked with, Dua Lipa, Anne-Marie, Rita Ora, do you already have this preconceived idea of what they need to do and the role they need to fill in terms of how they sound on the track? Or do you kind of go in with a very blank canvas and just see what they bring to the table and work around that? How do you approach it?
It really depends what it is. So in my career, I suppose it's quite unusual, especially these days, but a lot of the time, the records that you're hearing are actually written before the artist is involved. So like with Dua Lipa, for example, Be The One was written with me and a girl, really talented girl called Lucy Taylor. Shouts to her. She's amazing. Her name is Pause. So me and her wrote a song together. We didn't even know who Dua Lipa was at that point, and because she was just emerging. And then we were, she was kind of put on our radar as someone who would sound great on the record, and we'd heard some demos and we were like, she's amazing, and that made sense. So in that case, it was really a case of getting in the studio and helping Dua record it and turn it into her record, you know. But the song was there already, and that's the same with Leave Before You Love Me that I did last year for Marshmello and Jonas Brothers, and the same with actually No Money by Galantis. Like, was we written the song, but the production, they went in and completely changed. Louis Tomlinson, Back to You, that was written before BB or Louis got involved. Quite a few of these records are written like that. Cigala, the same thing again. The Cash Cash one was a joint thing, but that was all done kind of like remotely. I sent over a chorus to those guys, and they kind of finished it. But then there are other examples of songs that have been done in the room, you know, where it's just, I suppose, you kind of just catch a vibe and see what works.
Yeah, I suppose you just go off whatever the artist is kind of feeling, how they work, and it's kind of test.
Exactly.
It's
testing. When I worked with Mimi, I did her first song called Before I Go, and that was just written us three around a piano, which was really nice, and she's really awesome and a great writer. And you know, it's actually quite rare to find artists who are really brilliant writers. There obviously are many of them. A lot of our favorite guys, like the Adeles and stuff, I imagine, incredible writers. Yeah. But it's quite rare.
You've set me up perfectly, really, for what I want to ask next, because, and this really goes with being advice for new artists, particularly songwriters, what makes a brilliant songwriter? And for someone starting off on that journey, what do they need to be nailing from the off to make sure that, do you know what, yeah, even if they're not writing the best song straight away, they're giving themselves the best chance to create those songs down the line?
I think there's a few facets. As a songwriter in particular, there's various things that never have changed or gone out of fashion. A being, you know, at the end of the day, we're writing music, so the melodies have got to be amazing. They've got to be catchy, and where possible, they've got to be unique. And my kind of golden rule is that things should stay quite simple. Like, people are generally, especially when they're out and about, they don't have massive attention spans. Even though it was amazing, because we were talking about this before we were listening, Bohemian Rhapsody came on in the car, and we were like, it's mental, but it's like 7 minutes long, but I know every word.
Yeah,
more than I do many songs that are 2 minutes long now, because it's like, even though it's really complex as a song and I don't even understand half of it, it's still very, like, it's just so catchy the whole way through, and it's so unique, and every part you just remember. And a lot of that comes down to the next part, which is the lyrics, which is obviously just as important. So the lyrics have got to be bang on point. And I think the lyrics go in trends right now, especially with TikTok and stuff. It seems like there's this theme right now. I don't particularly love it, but it seems like a lot of people gravitate towards, they're almost like riddles, you know, where at the end there's a big reveal, you know, like there's that recent song by Lauren Spencer Smith or whatever. It's like the lyric, and then I guess you had your fingers crossed or whatever. Without that last line, it doesn't make sense. It's not like, in my opinion, it wouldn't be the smash that it is or whatever without that last line. And we often call that like the tagline or the hook or whatever, you know.
I don't know if it's just me that's seen this. Have you caught this wave of people writing quite angsty lyrics? I'm thinking of, well, the Billie Eilish's of the world, certainly Olivia Rodrigo, like that kind of angsty breakup, tapping into that first thing.
I think that Olivia Rodrigo song is amazing, by the way. But like, again, it's a similar kind of thing. It's a bit of a riddle, and it's a bit of like a, you almost read it like a poem or whatever. Like, I think people like these lyrics at the moment. Maybe it's got something to do with TikTok. I don't know. Maybe they make it easy to do a video to or something. I don't know. But it's definitely not going anywhere, that style of writing. I think that will change though from time to time. There might be another era that emerges where people don't care so much about having a complicated lyric. It could just be a nice, you know, relatable lyric. And then I think the other, you know, there's various other things. Structure, generally, if you want to get going in songwriting, just to understand the most simple structure, it's literally just intro, verse, pre-chorus, chorus, and then that repeats. You know, that will get you, I would say, 75% of pop songs, if not more, out on the radio will have that structure. It doesn't matter what emotion it is or what you're going for, but a song should evoke some kind of emotion, whether that's angry, sad, happy. It needs to make you feel something. I mean, maybe that's an obvious point, but sometimes you hear music and you're like, I don't really know kind of how I'm meant to feel about this. Essentially, what makes you want to keep singing something and what makes you want to listen over and over again?
Sure. What's your main bit of advice to new and unsigned artists in general, starting off now with the state that the music industry is currently in?
We get asked this a lot because we run a publishing company, and I would just say, it doesn't matter what point in your career you are, you're never going to stop having to hustle and go out and do things yourself. And I know that doesn't necessarily give like a, oh my God, I know now exactly what to do, but you just got to get up and go out and find and create your own opportunities, because no one's going to come knocking on your door. You know, make the best music you can. That's part one. But there are unfortunately millions of kids out there who've got brilliant songs sitting on their computers that no one will ever hear. And the part two is in many ways more important than part one, which is getting it in front of people. It was funny, I put it on my Instagram, I found a thing from like when I was probably 21 of me just like emailing like tons of managers and stuff and like trying to get people's attention. And I wrote the email in like a weird way, which never made any difference, but you could see I was kind of trying to be creative. And I'd done it like, I'm sure this in like bold letters, like, I know this probably won't get your attention or something, you know, just got to be creative. Think outside the box, you know, just jump at anything you can and make sure you're the best in the world. That's it. You know, keep going, keep trying, keep trying, keep trying. And also, like, this is not maybe the advice many people would want, but not everyone's going to be the best music producer or singer or writer in the world. So I would say, be aware and know if it's not right for you, you know, because you can waste a lot of time and years and money. Ask everyone around you what they think of your music constantly. That's what I still do, you know. It might help you find what you are good at. So,
which is equally important, I think, you know, when you're on that journey, knowing what you're not good at, or maybe where your strengths lie in another part of life. And I really like that bit of advice. I think that's really cool. You know, when you were saying how you were emailing lots of managers, I just really want to hone in on that, just so that someone can take away a practical thing from this. Where did you find all of these? I know I'm asking you to cast your mind back a bit, but where did you find all of these email addresses? Because some people would be there like, right, okay, I want to email someone. Who?
First of all, I would say, well, back in the day, I think there was a book, literally, though, I can't remember what it was called.
That's a useful book.
It was called The Rev. I can't remember what it was called, but there was a book literally printed by like Music Week or something that had thousands of addresses and emails in it. I don't know if I believe that that is really the way to go. I don't know. Maybe it is. Like, I think you can waste a lot of time just randomly emailing people. I think there's ways to make proper connections by getting yourself out there and actually, you know, meeting people, or even online, like using Instagram and stuff like that, you know, where you're drawing other people's attention rather than you bombarding people. I mean, it might work. It's just that I don't know if people in the industry pay that much attention these days to that. Maybe they do. I actually do always reply to stuff, but I normally get hit up on Instagram, which is a really good source, I would say, more than email these days.
Yeah, I mean, you replied to me on Instagram, like, which I respect, because the amount of followers you've got, it's probably easy for things to slip through the net.
Part of our of the roster of the company that we run has come from people just hit me up on Instagram, you know, and them being amazing, us being like, we need to sign this kid, they're incredible. And then so yeah, maybe, I don't know, the email one's a funny one. I just find email quite a dated thing now. And it's quite, I think people see it as maybe more personal than if you were to be hit up on social media. The other thing I was going to say is, I think it's important that when you are sending, if you are emailing, or if you're sending on Instagram, don't send people 1,000 songs. Just send them one or two top three songs, you know. I don't want to hear 40 songs because I know instantly they're not, unless you're literally Mozart, they're not going to be all A stars, and you're probably going to put me off more by me listening to the wrong ones rather than you telling me this is the one you need to hear. I would send one or two songs, and don't send them until everyone around you tells you these are amazing.
Got you. That's really interesting. I want to switch things up a little bit. I feel like I'm doing you and me a disservice, and anyone listening a disservice, if I don't ask about your electronic pig helmet, because I think it's sick. I mean, it's a massive part of your thing, man. It's like, it's what you do. And I thought, oh, I could go really basic and be like, how did you first come across it? Or like, what gave you the idea? But I want to ask, do you leave that thing charging overnight? Is it battery operated? What's the deal?
It's we plug it in and it charges, unfortunately. It's a nightmare, but it's been very good, though. It's fine. We actually had it made by a wicked company recently. It took forever. I think we've chipped it, annoyingly, so I need to get it changed. But yeah, we leave it charging overnight. It's like a Tesla, but it's not a Tesla.
I'm just terrified that you were to lose it, because the amount of things I've just left on like planes or like, you know, in a taxi or whatever.
Well, I'm hoping it's insured, but I need to check. Good point. You've reminded me.
You should probably check that.
No, I will do. But yeah, no, I'm glad you like it, man. Thank you.
No worries at all, man. I want to ask you, what's next? What's the future of digital farm animals? Obviously, you've just kind of recently come off the back of that amazing Charlie XCX and Rina Sawayama track with Beg For You, which, by the way, congrats on. Well, I know that Charlie's Crash went to number one in the UK, which was amazing to see, because I'm a huge Charlie fan anyway. So you've come off the back of that. What's next? Is there any, like, exclusives?
Yeah, so my next, you know, my lot, pretty much this whole year has been, I think I can say this, has been like, I'm just working on the KSI album right now, so I'm exec producing the album.
Wow.
It's sounding amazing. There's loads of songs, kind of just in the middle of it now, and yeah, we're just working on the single, so it's going to be really fun. And then also I have a Marshmello record coming. I can't really say much about, I'm not on it as me, but I've just written and produced it, so that's coming, I think, in June. And then very fun little bits, but they're the main things, like, up until this period. I've done the only other thing I've got out right now is there's a Clean Bandit record called Everything But You, which is quite a cool song.
Really good song.
Thank you. So yeah, that's kind of been my year, really.
Amazing.
I'm going on holiday, which I can't wait for.
Don't blame you. what's it like to work with JJ, and how did it come? Did he specifically ask you? Did he say, Nick, I want you to exec produce my album?
Yeah, well, his manager, who's an amazing manager and a good friend of mine called Mams Taylor, he's a really great character. And I've known him for years, weirdly enough. And we reconnected when I heard JJ's music. I met him when I was like probably my early 20s. And then obviously we just kind of lost touch at some point. And then we got back in touch and we've just became really close, and we did the last project essentially together. And it was just working so well that he asked me very kindly to exec along with him. So I'm kind of co-execing it with him, this project. And we've kind of just spent a large chunk of this year together banging our heads, working out which songs and which style and which direction we should go in. And it's sounding amazing. I'm really excited.
How is it working with JJ? Like, you guys clearly must have a lot of chemistry in the studio if you're working with him again.
Yeah, amazing. Amazing. He's a lovely guy. You'd never know just by his personality that he was a huge famous artist. Like, he's just a cool guy. He's always very humble. He's not even a particularly loud character when he's in the room, you know. He's just very chilled. He's just a cool guy. I think that's why people like him. He's very relatable and he's so talented. And the other thing is that I respect, and this is what makes him great, he's talented, but I think his biggest talent is that he works harder than everyone else. So he'll go into the booth and he'll just be like, okay, let's do a song. He'll spend 2 hours in there. He's like, let's do the next song. He's literally will spend like, he won't move from the booth. He'll just do like 6 hours sitting in a booth, just recording song after song after song, editing himself until we get it right. And I think you can't really beat that.
As a producer, you know, surely for you, that's a dream, because you've just got so much
to
work
with. Yeah, it is. Because I think he's aware that he's not always going to get it right. Some people will get in the booth and he'll be like, okay, I'm gone now. And you know you haven't got it right. And then you've got to spend hours like mending something that's unmendable. And with him, I think he's aware that he's not the best vocalist in the world, but he'll sit there until it sounds like the best vocal, you know? And that's what's going to make him one of the biggest musicians worldwide as well.